get started. There might be some people joining us, and as we go along, we do these PLCs every 2 weeks, same time, same place, same call-in number. And we've been talking the last three PLCs or so about placement. We hit on highlights, and then we talk about them on the PLCs. And then we, after that, we'll write a Connect newsletter, which you'll be getting next week, about what we've talked about in the PLCs. We also write notes on each PLC, and you'll be getting those on Friday. So if you get those notes on Friday, everything will be fine. It'll summarize what we've talked about today, add websites in, and other supplemental information. If for some reason you don't get the notes, just send your contact information to hkballou@eicc.edu, hkballou@eicc.edu, and she'll make sure you're on our PLC list. We have two lists. We have a listserv, an outreach listserv that is much larger, about 1,000 people, and then we have the PLC participant list, which is smaller. It's about 450 people, and those are the people that get the notes, and the both get announcements. So you might get announcements, but if you don't get the notes, then just send your contact information to hkballou@eicc, and we'll make sure you're on the participant list.
And hey, Mike and Heather, I just wanted to let you guys know, Mike does a lot of work on those notes, and there really is some fantastic information in it. If you haven't either read through them all recently or haven't received them, he really goes above and beyond to make sure he can keep you guys up to date on upcoming conferences and workshops and funding opportunities. And there's a significant amount of fantastic information that's available in those notes. So don't hesitate to send me an email. I'd be happy to get you on that list as well.
Good. And just in time, because Heather's going to brief us on what's going on or not going on in Washington and a little bit about what's going on forward. I know there's a lot of questions about the annual grantee meeting and the national brownfields meeting. So, Heather?
Absolutely. Well, you know, again, from the headquarters side of things, you know, we're in that long wait period. Sort of the same story we've been singing every PLC here for the last couple times, where we're just sort of in that in-between time. They're in the process of reviewing the proposals, and they are, you know, estimating that, you know, we'll get that information out here in that October timeframe that Mike's been talking about the last couple of weeks as well. So they do always want to push and make sure everybody's aware that the National Brownfields Conference will be happening, and that'll be December 11th through the 13th in Los Angeles, California. So that's a kind of a really nice segue to get us into our all grantee meeting. So as you guys have heard, also probably the last couple of weeks, we're doing something a little different this year. We are actually looking at doing an affiliate event sort of right before the start of this National Brownfields Conference. So we're looking at actually having the all grantee meeting on December 10th in Los Angeles. And it'll, like I said, it'll just occur the day before the National Brownfields Conference. So in order to attend, though, you will have to register for the National Brownfields Conference, so please keep that in mind. Now, I know that information is a little slow coming out, especially in terms of housing. We are in the process of trying to figure out how to kind of keep to the spirit of what we've done with the all grantee meetings in the past, and that is we are looking at covering housing costs for the December 9th and December 10th dates, basically the night before and the night of the all grantee meeting. You know, we want to make sure that we can help cover those costs to make sure that everybody can come and participate and things like that. This is a little bit of a novel thing, even for the National Brownfields Conference. It's definitely a novel thing for us doing it in this way. So I apologize that it's taking a little bit longer to get some of these ducks in a row and things worked out. We are working with the National Brownfields Conference folk to see about getting a specific blocks of rooms out of their block that they have have reserved for the National Brownfields Conference, specifically for our all grantee meeting folk. Thank you guys to those of you who responded to that listserv post that I sent out last week. Since this is all something kind of new for us, we wanted to make sure that we were looking at having the right number of rooms reserved in that block to make sure that we could have space to accommodate everybody. So again, I wanted to thank you guys endlessly for your patience. And please know we are working on it and it's coming. It's just we've got a couple of new kinks to kind of work through since it's something brand new and a little different. But we're very excited about this opportunity and are looking to have a really great day of programming for you guys on December 10th. And then you'll be able to enjoy the rest of the National Brownfields Conference and a really great idea to allow you to be able to intermingle with other types of folks that work in the brownfields field, some employers, different things like that as well. So we are greatly looking forward to that. On another note, too, I wanted to let you guys know, for those of you that are on our listserv, I apologize. There was a couple emails going out that I didn't necessarily intend to have sent out to the full listserv. We're just working through some internal settings, got changed on some stuff, so we're working on adjusting those. So we should be getting back to the frequency of listserv posts that you guys are a little bit more accustomed to. But we do want to let you guys know that we are working on that. And on that same note, though, thank to all of you guys who participated in the transportation conversation that we were having last week and the week before. Really fantastic to hear everybody's insight, and we've worked really hard to capture that all together, and we'll get that information out to you guys as well in Mike's notes as well as some other opportunities too.
Great. And so the short story is if you sign up for the National Brownfields meeting, maybe hold back on your hotel reservations. They could always be canceled if you've already made some reservations. But we're going to arrange something so that we'll get 2 days of reimbursements, and then, of course, you'd have to pick up the rest of the meeting in that case. So kind of hold off. That's in a flux situation. We're thinking of our block will be at the Sheraton. So if you for some reason want to make sure that you just are registered and want to register to share, and you can do that, and we could always change those reservations later if we need to. So we'll also be soliciting you for all kinds of ideas about this meeting. As Heather said, it's kind of new turf, but I think it'll be pretty exciting. If you are thinking of going to the all grantee meeting that's prior to the National Brownfields meeting, why don't you just drop Heather a note, and many of you have already done that you're planning on attending. This is not a registration, but it'll just give her an idea. And remember that PLC members are invited to the all grantee meeting. And while we call it all grantee meeting, those of you who are interested in establishing a program and are PLC members are eligible to attend. So you could just send her a note that you're thinking of doing that and you'd like to do that, and we'll make sure you are on that list. Any other announcements, and we have a bunch about upcoming meetings, will be on the post-session notes that you'll get on Friday. But today what we were talking about, the last three PLCs we've been talking about placement, and the Connect issue, as I said, that'll be coming out soon. It'll sum up the idea of participant placement. But at the end of the last PLC, we had a beginnings of an interesting discussion that we felt was worth revisiting, and that was about transportation. And almost everyone pretty much agrees that being able to drive to class, being able to drive to the job, with some exceptions, is an impediment to placement. So we wanted to examine this further, and what we did is we sent out a listserv, and thank you, 25 people who gave us insights of what they've done and gave us an idea that we could explore further. So what we want to do today is we want to talk about some of those ideas, what we found overall, and maybe some helpful hints or something you might explore in terms of your particular situation. As we said, almost everyone has some sort of issue. Do you have a car? Do you not have a car? Do you have a driver's license? Was your driver's license revoked? That type of thing. So we're going to divide this into And it turns out, like everything in our job training program, everything is pretty much different with every program. Everyone's got a different situation. If you're a heavy urban community, it might be one way. If you're in a rural community, it's another way. If you're in Alaska, it's another thing. If you're and Louisiana, it's different. So it's different wherever you go, and a lot depends on your public transportation network, your distribution of employers, the target community that you're targeting. So let's try to put these into different categories. First of all, we've got people who don't have cars. You're in a community, they don't need cars. They live in an urban community. They live in Adams Morgan in D.C., or they live in the middle of New York. They have no intention of ever getting a car. They don't need them. They don't want them. This is one class of people. They don't need driver's license. They probably never even had one for some of them. What they may do is they may need an ID, and that's just one thing that you may want to think about if you don't require any kind of identification, is what kind of ID. And, of course, we've been hearing more and more about real ID that's coming out. That'll be due if they ever want to get on an airplane. Maybe this will migrate to other forms of transportation. They'll need a real ID for security purposes. That requires a birth certificate and a couple of pieces of identification, which we'll put in the notes. And it's not a bad thing to have all of your participants when they come in the program. If they don't have an ID, get an ID. Show them how to do that. They're not expensive. Thank you, Alaska. In Alaska, they're $15. In Missouri, they're $11 for 6 years. So they're not expensive. There's no tests. It's mostly identifying yourself. It's many of them call them driver IDs and non-driver IDs, and many of them look exactly the same, except for one, you can't be operating a motor vehicle. So it's really probably a good thing in all your programs to have everyone have an ID. Probably almost all of you make sure everyone has an email so you can keep in touch with them. Some of those emails may have to be revised so they're not obscene or detrimental to their employment. You want to make sure that they've got business kind of IDs as far as their email goes. This is for transmitting of resumes later on when they go for employment or communications with their employer. You might as well get them off on the right start and get everyone an email address. The more consistent they are, the better it is. They may have a Facebook ID, or they may have other sorts of social media IDs. That's something that you may want to just get right off the bat when you get your new program started. Now let's talk about programs that people may be driving, maybe not. And when we poll all of the grantees, it's interesting. It's almost about half and half about those who don't require a driver's license and those who do require a driver's license, and both have good reasons. We've got, and in many cases, if you're those who don't really require it are heavy urban areas, might be a community like ECA in Philadelphia where they've got very good transportation networks, and we'll talk about later. They also have some good mitigation efforts for those people that live in the city. They're places that are actually very rural, like Alaska Forum, which we have on today, which we could talk about later. Many of their students, it's not that they're in an urban environment, it's their target community. They don't have driver's licenses. Many of them may live in small towns and very, very rural, and they could work around that. It may be somewhat of an impediment to employment, but it's possible. So you may have places like St. Nick's, Goodwill, Land Force, ECA, where they are bringing people into the program without driver's license, and we'll talk about that in a bit. We also have grantees who say, no, we've got to have it as a criteria for acceptance, because if we can't get them to class and if we can't get them to the job, what use is even going through this exercise? And these are fair reasons. Earth's Conservancy, for example, simply states we don't have good public transportation. They can't get to the training. If they can't get to training, how are they going to get to the job? Others, they may be able to get to the training, but they just can't get to the job because their employers are dispersed. Their employers may be in the suburb. You may have a situation where you're what I call an employer desert. You're in the west side of Chicago, or you're in the middle of a community where employer flight has taken place. They've moved out to the suburbs, and your training may be in the inner city. They may be able to get to training on a bus or be in the community, but once you've graduated them, they just can't get to the job, or it's so difficult to the job they can't maintain sustained employment. It's just too hard. They have to take 3-4 buses, and participants do. Having said that, we've had many interviews with students who said, I take 2-3 buses to get to work, and I do it every day. And they are driven, and they are successful. It is an impediment, and it's an issue. It's the question you have to ask yourself is this going to be too hard for too many people, and do we have to make it a reason for entering the program as a screening technique? And that's your decision. And there's not a right or wrong answer to this. It's really, it doesn't make your program any more successful or less successful or more appropriate to the target group or less target group. It's something you have to consider. And I think it's a good consideration when you're developing your screening methods. And in our Connect issue, we focus on when you're looking at placement, the philosophy is the best practice is work backwards. Start with your employers. Where are they located? What are their restrictions? What type of people are they looking for? What kind of curriculum do they need? What kind of certifications do they have? For example, they may be a great employer and they're going to hire a lot of your people, but I'm sorry, but you just can't take ex-offenders. And that may be a hard decision you have to make, that you can't take ex-offenders into the program, even though you would like to. Others may say, some of our employers don't, but some of our do, and we can find employers who will take them. And then that again, working backwards. If you have no employers who are willing to work with your graduates, why start? So we're always telling people, work backwards. Do your labor market assessment, which we call something different than what EPA requires. Our labor market assessment is actually identifying your employers. Before you even start, before your first class starts, you will want to, if you can, lock down your employers and say, we'll hire some of your people or we'll look at some of your people, but we're located in Schaumburg and your class is in downtown Chicago. And if they can't get out here, I'm sorry, it's just not going to be, they're not going to be reliable. We won't be able to do it. Or they may say, well, we've got enough people in the city that if you can get them to a drop-off point, we'll pick them up and we'll get them. There's such a need for them and we're willing to work with them. So again, we're working backwards. And the same goes not only with transportation, but it goes with curriculum, life skills, and your entire program, and definitely your screening method. So try to lock down certain employers who you feel will be the ones who will be hiring your graduates, see what they want, see what they need, and then kind of work backwards. Now, when we talk about transportation, of course, we're a little out of the environment, workforce development, job training arena because they don't support driver's licenses. They support commercial driver's licenses because it has to do with the transporting hazardous materials. But as far as personal driver's licenses, they don't. And as we talked at the end of the discussion of the last PLC, it's very hard to find anyone who will. So let's dive into that and talk a little bit about that. When we talk about people who don't have driver's licenses, they feel they're going to need them or they want them. What can we do? And how could we service our population? And you could break these people into two groups, I would say. One, that they've never had a driver's license, but they would like one. They don't even have a car, but they'd like a driver's license. And there's lots of programs for these people. They're not EPA programs. They're programs that are sponsored by AAA, Safe Drivers programs. There are county programs, and they even have reduced fees for some people. There's organizations like St. Nick's who might help with getting that driver's permitting, getting permits. Landforce, for example, indicated that they'll actually pay for the permits, not out of EPA funds. We're talking off, these are funds supported by benefactors, donors, or perhaps some other foundation that's leveraging your job training program. The star, I think, is Uberall. They do a tremendous job. They, on all social services, they accept ex-offenders, they accept people with drug issues, housing issues, all across the line. And they are really set up as one of these organizations, which we'll talk about in future PLCs, that they had a social service organization, and they added environmental workforce development and job training into their whole host of other services. So they were able to take this big ball of services that they're providing the community, and they were able to attach. And then something like St. Nick's, to another extent, or other organizations, Goodwill, they were able to attach the environmental training component to enhance the services they provide. The nice thing about this is Uberall has gone into, they recognize this problem with drivers, and they actually have a driver training program. They've gotten foundation money and money to support a local driver school that can help train some of their students. Now, these programs are longer-term programs. They've incorporated environmental workforce into them. They've actually had some success, and I think everyone was agreeing that they couldn't get any money out of a Department of Labor. But they mentioned, and we're going to look into this further, program called Out of School. And if someone's on the call, they may want to talk about that in a minute. It's an out-of-school program where they help support first-time drivers after they've received training to get driver's licenses. So we have, a dozen or so people who are helping people get driver's licenses who don't have driver's license. They're motivated to have them. They'd like to have them. And they're willing to go through the process. And some of it may be on their dime, and others are supported by foundation money that's coming in, and companies who are willing to assist people help to go to driver school. They also mention videos that are on the web that can help in some of the pre-driver training, certainly not in the hands-on, but in the things like the signs and some of the introductory material that they can help. And some of the Department of Motor Vehicles around the country also have these programs. So if you've got some motivated students who would like to go to driver's school, and of course you can't pay for it with EPA money, but you may start looking into foundation money, private sector money, and maybe I would say link up with a social service organization like Rural or one of the Goodwill, St. Nick's, one of the community social service organizations that may be providing that already for their services, and you would leverage or partner with them and maybe even do a trade in terms of providing some environmental workforce courses to them or health and safety courses in return to letting them work with some of your students on that preliminary driver's license. Now, of course, once they get that, if you have certain students who want to go for their CDL, you can get those funded both with labor funds and I believe EPA funds if you could link it to hazardous materials. So that would be the strategy for those people who are new, want driver's license, are motivated, need to get out to the suburbs or somewhere to go to work. You can enter them in that program. You might also enter them in that program after they graduate. In other words, they may go through the environmental training, and they may or may not be successful in getting a job, but you may be able to help them as a postgraduate assistance to get their driver's license and nurture them along. Of course, as I said, this all requires supplemental money by companies, foundations. Some people have been very successful in finding that in the Northwest, the gentleman from Delaware indicated that he was at a conference where they were talking about a similar thing and had the similar problems that we're talking about today, that actually $600,000 was by Pacific Northwest Community Impact was established to help nonprofits on this very issue. And their idea was buying prepaid cards to Uber and Lyft to get them to training and then to their job. I think in reading this, the only issue is this really a long-term sustainable answer? We've got a lot of programs where you can go to Uber and Lyft and they'll subsidize students going to class. And I believe one of the grantees said Uber will subsidize going to class and up to 6 months after graduation with Uber and Lyft. And that's short-term solution, but a possible solution. So again, if you're going in that direction, it's something you may want to consider contacting Lyft and Uber as a donation in your community, and they may lead you one of their programs or will into one of their philanthropic programs. The next issue that I want to talk about is what happens to your participants who have lost their driver's license. They had one, but there's a whole lot of reasons they don't have one now. And you may be in a community where they need one. They may be in your program and they said they had a driver's license or had one and lost it while they were in your program. What do you do? And then you may be finding yourself in a community that where they need their own transportation. Several, again, those grantees who are part of a bigger program have solutions that are very interesting. LandForce, for example, has a pro bono attorney that they use for a lot of different reasons, but they can go to court and they set up a payment plan for people who have, say, fines. They've either suspended or they've got back fines. There's a lot of reasons someone loses his license. It may be for they're delinquent on their child support. They may have a drug infraction that some, in some cases, in fact, in Delaware, they said they were able to get that Delaware one rescinded. There was a rule where if you've got a drug offense, we're going to take your license away. Well, I can understand why these things are used as a punishment or an incentive not to use drugs or to pay child support. The downside to these are how do you pay child support if you don't have a job and you can't get a job? So there's two sides of this, you could argue either side of this. If you take away their driver's license, that'll get them paying child support. But if they are indigent, they don't have a job, and they can't earn money or get money to pay child support, how do you do it without a license if there's no way to get to the job? And then particularly if you have a job. If you've gone through an environmental workforce development job training program, you've got the credentials, and you've got an employer who's willing to hire you if you can drive, but you need to drive. And I think LandForce has an interesting solution to that is with pro bono attorney. They help the program with ex-offender issues, and they'll go to court and set up a payment plan. So they'll say, they'll pose the argument I just did, and say, let's set up a payment plan, and if you allow them to get to their jobs. And this takes care of fines and suspensions, and it's one possible solution. You would have to reach out to an attorney that could do some pro bono work for your organization and work with it. We have cases with Arch Hanks up in Cypress Mandela in Oakland. He actually goes to the court himself, and the judge knows him, and he will vouch for his students and try to strike some sort of a deal. We actually even had one person indicate that a possibility was a state representative, someone representing your district, who may be sympathetic if you explain the program and the situation to and talk to the student to reinstate a driver's license that had been revoked. These are tricky issues and take a lot of time, but it's, again, we're trying to do something in a very, we have a very difficult critical issue and we're looking for some sort of solution. There's other solutions that some state DMVs have some forgiveness programs that are based on need. If you could present what I just presented to someone in the DMV, they may, again, work out a deal without an attorney or going to the courts. AAA also has some safe driving programs where if you go through the programs, they'll reduce the number of points that you have against your license. And that's something, again, you can encourage it. These are all issues that really are outside the arena of EPA funding environmental job training programs. And I think it's important we talk about them because they're critical issues to placing your students, even though EPA is not involved in them. That's something they don't look at. Other programs, I believe, like the NIHS programs, have more leeway in how they could spend some funds on some of these other issues. But certainly it's something that everyone confronts. Before we talk about questions, but I do want to go back to that Ubero program. They have some great ideas, and I'll put some of the ideas in the notes that we send out on Friday. They have business partners that will also pick up participants at central locations like bus stops, and they'll bring them to the work site. And how this works is if you have an employer, say they're a tank manufacturer or an underground storage tank person, or they're an asbestos removal company or lead removal company or that type of program where they're hiring multiple people from your program, they may be willing to pick up people, maybe even at your training facility or a prepaid bus, predetermined location, and they'll send one of their staffers out and pick you up. Pretty much like a lot of construction teams, when you go out and you look at them repairing pipes, you won't see, in some areas you will, in more rural areas, lots of half a dozen cars, but often they'll bring the whole work crew. So those work crews report to a central location. And this is a strategy that's been successful with ECA in Philadelphia. They manage to bring students who don't have licenses and can't get to jobs. They place them with employers like the city-based recycling facilities or waste management facilities or FEMA. What they can do is you take those students who lost their licenses, can't get new ones, don't have them, they're in your program, you're trying to place them, start going to facilities that have central locations where the employees are expected to report for duty at the location, and then they're trucked to the sites where they'll be working. And, of course, municipal utilities are a prime example. Recycling is a very good one. Waste sites, scrap yards might even be the same, or waste management facilities. And that would be another strategy you could use. So what I've done here is talk about a whole lot of different issues that all of you have, but every one of you has a different issue and how you're going to address it. And you may just have to, the fallback position is, we're using it as a screening method. You have to have, just as you may have to have a GED or a high school diploma, you have to have a driver's license. You may be in a situation that says, we can go beyond that. And we can, as one program stated, we put it in our literature, but we make exceptions, and you could find students that you find a path to employment by working with them on either getting their learner's permit or working with them after graduation or sending through one of these programs, or you may have already set up some kind of subsidized program that can get them off their feet. And then, of course, the next more aggressive issue is for those who lose their licenses or have criminal records that don't allow them to do it, to try to get attorneys to help you with that. So each one of these is more and more and more involvement, more and more resources required, and more of your time required. And really, you're the ones that's going to have to determine where you want to be on that spectrum. And I would say one word of caution is whatever you do, don't do your whole class in one of those. If you say, we could get everyone jobs before you know that, and then you get slammed about 4 weeks into the program that none of your students can get to the job, that's probably the word of caution. You don't want to learn after your first cohort that you can't place your students only because they don't have driver's licenses or they can't get to the job or they lost their driver's license. So I would say pre-think that whole process before you go too far. So has anything I said made sense or incorrect, or you have any ideas of some of the people that are online of what you're doing that works or doesn't work?
I think for one correction, a picture ID is required to satisfy I-9 employment requirements. I don't know of a single state that will, so the ID issue is not an issue. It's the issue of employers asking for a valid driver's license. And number one, they're asking for a valid license. Number two, you may have a license, but then once they run your abstract, their insurance company may say, hey, you had too many points on your license. The third issue is each state is different as far as their penalties are concerned for removal of a license. And because of the interstate compact, you cannot, for example, New Jersey is very strict. The only assistance that you can get is if the only reason that your license is suspended is because you did not pay fines, and you can go to court and go on a time payment and adhere to it, not for any criminal, not for any zero. Interstate compact will not allow you to go to, say, Colorado, where you can get a I can only drive to go to work license, because they're bound to what your home, the convicting state, indicates.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very, very strict. The ID is a no-brainer. I mean,
yeah,
everyone. And now, do you give them help to get their IDs when they come into the program?
Put it this way. Everybody that comes into any program for anything has to be able to show that they, well, at least any of any Department of Labor, any government-sponsored program, that they are eligible to work in this country. And that has to be a picture ID. You have to have a passport. You have to have, or a green card. And what most people do is they go and they get, you know, a non-driver's ID, which is, you know, you can get them in at any county office throughout the country. That is not an issue. So if someone doesn't have one, that's easy.
They don't even get into the program. If they don't have one, they can't even get in.
Well, because they can't work. I mean, if you can't work, then you can't get into the program.
No. But you wouldn't help them get one, is what I'm saying.
Oh, well, we will tell them where to. In other words, if someone comes in and they are eligible to work, we just tell them, you know, here in New Jersey, where they would go. They would just go to, you know, to the county office or different municipalities, and they would get a non-driver's picture ID.
So that's a good approach. And then if you don't have it, then you go get the documentation and reapply for our program.
In other words, in order to get into our program, they have to show us that they're legal to work. The other thing is there are no federal funds, no WIOA money that can be used for a driver's license, period. If a WIOA or a workforce board is using money for a basic driver's license, whether it's for a youth program or an adult program, they're using money that is not federal.
Mm-hmm.
Federal money can't, that's why EPA money can't be used. Federal money cannot be used for...
only for a commercial driver's license.
Right, and CDL requires having a passenger license for 2 years.
Right. Okay. Very good. And so it's really a no-brainer. Now, so you're really saying if you're going to even come into this program, you've got to have a driver's license, really.
What we are being forced to do is exactly what you indicated. People are not going to be working on reclamation sites. They're not going to be working on brownfield sites. Even though we're in an urban area, the sites that they could be working on from day to day or week to week can be all over the state. So, and the employer requires a license. We have to start out with warehousing, with places that are fixed and
right.
people can get to, and that they can get to during for the shifts that they are required to get to.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a problem with training because we or our training entities will provide transportation funds, but it's for, and they will have to start out there and then move on once they get enough money to pay for a permit, to pay for behind the wheel training and for a license. The other issue is some employers don't only require a license, they require a reliable means of transportation, which
mm-hmm.
means a car.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So when you screen, say you're screening your applicants, you have a 50 applicants, you've got 20 seats to fill. How will you use that as a criteria?
No.
Will you use it as
it's discriminatory. It will discriminate against individuals with lower income, and it will discriminate against minorities because those are the populations who more than likely do not have licenses.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we will fine tune our placement and take the risk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good. What has your experience been? Have you found that the leftover people you can't place are those that can't get to the job or are not motivated enough to take the multiple transportation routes? Or
it's not a matter of multiple transportation. You can't take multiple transportation when it's not available if you have to
right.
be at a job site at 6 o'clock in the morning.
There
right. is, you know, it doesn't exist. And what we're trying to do now is fine-tune and identify areas that they can get to, and they will just have to start out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what we're talking about, maybe going to if it's a public utility or some sort of municipal
yes.
facility, and
yes.
if you can get them to that facility, they're taken
exactly.
care of.
Or a warehouse, you know, we can start out like that. Or in building maintenance, you know, that
right.
is where we will have to start.
Right. Interesting. It's interesting.
Many of the grantees do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you just, well, ideally, as I said, if you can work backwards and you get commitments from employers that are willing to have jobs like that, you're okay. If you don't, you're in a little bit of a pickle at the end of the
yeah.
training.
That is not something we're, you know.
No.
Employers aren't going to make a commitment for X number of jobs at X point in time. They're just
right.
not.
They can't,
so,
no.
Right. The only thing that we can do is know who they are and have, mm-hmm. you know, when it's getting close to placement, see what options there are.
Right, right. Very good. Yeah, we always suggest that often you won't get a commitment, but you can get a commitment to look at your students.
Oh, yeah, but anybody will do that, but then that doesn't mean they'll be hired.
No, that's right. That's right. Rochester was one of the few that they were able to get all the at our grantee meetings. We were talking about that. They got all their city vendors together and asked for commitments in the same room. And of course, they didn't pledge that they would, but they kind of pledged a commitment to look at them. And of course, all the vendors were happy to volunteer that opportunity.
Like
anything
said,
that other
look at them, but hiring
yeah.
is a different issue.
Yeah, it's a good start. Well, as we have always said, this is not an easy program, and you do the best you can. You really do. Mm-hmm. And you could help a whole lot of people, and some you may or may not be able to help. That's part of it. Any ideas that other people might have? Alaska was an interesting situation because I was surprised to hear when they noticed that many of their people don't have driver's license and they don't drive. But it's just the nature of their location and where they're at.
I can speak a little to that. I'm April in Alaska with the Race Jet Programs Indoor Environmental. So we don't require driver's license. And lots of people don't have driver's license. There's just, you know, some people don't, some folks don't even have roads. Like there may be the, you know, if it's a big community, it might have wheelers, that kind of thing. But everyone generally has a BIA card or an ID, Alaska ID, and so that will get them on the plane. We do require, we leverage with Alaska State Department of Labor in the STEP program, and we require their Social Security card. We do have people ask about CDL driver's license later, but we haven't been able to help with that at all. But in regards to our program, you know, their BIA card will get them on the plane and back, and generally, as Meg said from AFE, they do generally have IDs other than driver's license. When they come into town, we do offer space that they can go and get a driver's license.
Oh, okay. And when they graduate, their employers, when they you're typified by lots of dispersed small communities, correct?
Correct.
So they can actually go to the waste plant, or they can work in a recycling facility, that type of thing. And
they tend to work with their IGAP departments, the environmental department, primarily working with landfill and environmental health issues. Yeah.
Okay. So it isn't absolutely necessary. It is amazing that people have been able to get around without these licenses.
Yeah, those in particular. But the IDs, you know, serve
everyone
pretty
well. Needs it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good. Any other ideas? It's a topic that we need to keep discussing and finding solutions to. And as I said, our grantees are so dispersed in different communities and different transportation networks, different employers, different types of employers, that everyone it's going to be a case by case, as we said, and probably ranging from New Jersey to something like maybe Philadelphia, where there's plenty of jobs locally and good transportation networks that they could use. Very good. Well, if there aren't any other questions, we'll go on to the next topic and the next PLC in 2 weeks. So that would be September 11th. So between now, if you have any questions, send them to Heather. If you're not on the PLC list, send them contact information to Heather, and we'll talk to you all then. Thank you so much for participating, and thank you for all your ideas.
Thank you.
Have a good day, everybody.